The next case on our calendar is 08488, State of Ohio versus Kevin Bradley. Mr. Shockley.
Thank you, Chief Justice Moyer, Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. My name is Scott Shockling, and I'm here on behalf of the State of Ohio. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. This case, very briefly, in this case, Kevin Bradley's convictions were reversed originally because he wore jail garb at his trial. He was originally convicted of 15 offenses related to production of methamphetamine, primarily. On appeal, he pled guilty to significantly fewer offenses. I believe he was originally sentenced on 15 offenses. His remand involved 4. On remand, his sentences for 2 offenses, for vandalism, a fifth-degree felony, was increased from 6 months to 12, and his sentence for illegal assembly or possession of chemicals for manufacture of drugs, third-degree felony, was increased from 4 years to 5 years. What this case involves is whether or not the trial court, when it increased those 2 sentences, whether or not the trial court had rebutted the presumption of vindictiveness that arises under North Carolina versus Pierce, where a defendant receives an enhanced punishment for the exercise of a right, and whether or not this court's decision in State versus Saxon somehow precluded the trial court from reweighing the factors under revised code sections 2929.11 and .12 when it resentenced on remand. Prior to State versus Saxon, there was no dispute that a trial court on remand could look at sentences, at offenses that were dismissed as part of a post-remand plea agreement, so long as the aggregate offense on remand did not exceed the aggregate offense prior to the remand. And in the Second District, the State versus Nellums, the case that applied that prior to Saxon. And so the question becomes, as a result of Saxon, do trial courts still have that authority? The state believes that they do for the simple reason that Saxon should be limited to its facts. Saxon involved a case in which the assigned error involved fewer than all of the offenses. In this case, the error that was involved concerned all of the offenses. And therefore, unlike the situation in Saxon, where there was on direct appeal, there was an offense that was not affected by error, that should have remained, you know, after the appeal. In this case, there was nothing. Everything after the Second District was done back in 2005, when the case was originally reversed, returned to interlocutory status. The state of Ohio believes at that point in time that the court was free to consider all factors once again when it went to resentence the defendant.
Can you help me understand? Because it wasn't entirely clear to me. What factors did the judge have to weigh and consider the second time that wasn't also present the first time?
There were 2 factors. The first of all is on the remand, the defendant was indicted for additional charges arising out of some telephone calls that he made to his son on the eve of his first trial.
The judge did not know that and weigh that the first time. I know the charge was filed the second time, but the incident had occurred prior to the first sentencing. And so does that make a difference?
The judge should have been aware of it because tapes from those telephone calls were introduced at the defendant's first trial. So it was in the record as far as the contents of those phone calls. There were not the charges, though. The charges were brought after the remand. The second thing, and this is perhaps the number of charges that were involved. I mean, originally the defendant was convicted of 15 offenses. On remand, he pled guilty to 4. So there is, within that context, significantly fewer charges that are involved on the remand. So in theory, the trial court obviously has much fewer offenses to sentence a defendant for. Therefore, the possible aggregate offense, the aggregate sentence, is significantly reduced on the remand.
Does that implicate the sentence packaging doctrine, in your view?
The state would submit it does not, because in this case, all of the convictions were reversed on appeal. All the sentences were vacated on appeal. In Saxon, there was an error assigned to one of the sentences. There were two involved. And the Court of Appeals not only reversed the sentence with the error, but reversed the sentence that did not have the error as well, and sent it all back for resentencing. The thing that the state has a problem with in this case, when Saxon is brought up, is trying to conceptualize what is there after the fact. If somehow that six-month sentence for vandalism survives the reversal of the actual conviction, I mean, the state has a problem theorizing that as far as a sentence survives the reversal of the underlying conviction. The state's not aware of anything in other criminal litigation or in civil litigation where the reversal of the final judgment, there's still some sort of interlocutory ruling somewhere that somehow survives. I mean, courts are free to reconsider all their interlocutory rulings after the reversal of final judgment. Why shouldn't a trial court, following the reversal of all of the convictions in a case, be able to reconsider the sentence imposed for those various offenses on remand? And that's the point that the state's trying to make, is that this was an error, that unlike Saxon, this wasn't an error, that this error affected everything, and everything started anew thereafter. And therefore, the trial court should have the opportunity to look anew at those sentencing decisions, as opposed to being stuck, in effect, in lockstep with what was applied on the first case, which is what the Second District is trying to say, is that you, trial court, you impose 6 months the first time around. On remand, you have to give the same 6 months. The state doesn't think that's the case because you're allowing that decision to survive the reversal of the conviction.
Counsel, maybe a slightly different take on that, and it troubles me a little bit, but there's not really enough here maybe to sort of get a real good hold on it. The judge says something like, well, I have less charges to consider now, so that affects, and, you know, I thought the time was right, the amount of prison time was right the first time, so now I have to readjust it because I have a fewer number of cases. Doesn't that sound a little bit like maybe a different kind of packaging issues? That I want this sentence to in the aggregate to be what it was in the prior aggregate?
Two things come to mind. First of all, the judge in this case had to approve the plea agreement. This was not coming off of a jury verdict. So the judge had to approve the plea agreement. And judges are free in the state of Ohio to reject the plea agreement if they find that its terms are not correct or that they're unjust. The trial court was free in this case, if it had chosen to do so, to reject the plea agreement. The other thing, as far as going back to the reweighing, is the Second District in its decision made the point, as far as in the, granting the application for reconsideration, said that the dismissed charges could be considered for purposes of sentencing under Section 2929.11 of the Revised Code. The state asked the question, if those sentences, if those convictions, if those offenses that were dismissed as part of the plea agreement cannot be used to enhance or to increase the sentence on the remaining charges, what role can they play under 2929.11 and .12? Because in this case, the state would submit that the defendant's conduct post-remand was the same as his conduct after his first trial. There's nothing to change the conduct. Granted, there were fewer charges to which he pled guilty, but unlike the situation where you have a jury trial following a remand, in this case, there were no offenses, so to speak, of which he was found not guilty. So as far as the court's concerned, trial court, yeah, there's the same body of evidence there that was there the first trial. And it would seem to the court, the state, that they should be allowed to look at the number of sentences, to look at the number of offenses on remand, and to try and reweigh, to take into account the entire scope of the defendant's conduct, including
those
charges.
Counsel, isn't that what the language of the transcript suggests that the court did? On page 5 of the brief, you talk about, quoting, the court is giving up something in authorizing the plea to be accepted because the court believed in the sentence that it imposed originally, or the court wouldn't have imposed it then. So it required the court to look freshly at what the result is. Is that not, I mean, I don't know how you would interpret that other than he's looking anew at this and not just going through a rote recitation of what he's going to pare back these four sentence or these four charges to or convictions to receive.
That's correct. And the state submits the trial judge should be allowed to go back and look anew and to look once again, going back to the factors under 29.11 and 0.12 to make a new sentencing decision.
North Carolina, I'm sorry, were you finished answering your question?
As opposed to just, you did 6 months the first time, you should do 6 months on remand, which is what the state believes the Second District is saying in its decision granting the application for reconsideration.
What do we do with North Carolina versus Pierce, the test in North Carolina versus Pierce? Doesn't the trial judge have to find some new conduct, something new since the remand that or since the original convictions to
the state would submit there are those factors in this case. Yes, Pierce does require some sort of perhaps finding as far as something that casts new light. In this case, there would be, of course, the reduced number of sentences, which the state submits is new evidence or new light as far as for purposes of Pierce. And in this case, there's also the additional charges that were brought as a result of the solicitation of perjury of the defendant's son on the eve of his first trial.
That argument is almost logically inconsistent. An individual is convicted of 10 counts and receives a sentence of 25 years, mm-hmm. but on review, he should have only been convicted of 3 counts, and then on resentencing, he gets 25 years. One would think that the sentence should be reduced for less criminal conduct.
And perhaps if this had gone to trial on remand.
And I finish the point, as the Chief Justice points out, there needs to be something in the record to justify that sentence for the reduced criminal conduct, and I just don't think it's here.
Well, the state would submit that the trial judge was free to reweigh. The state would also submit that there is the additional charges as far as the solicitation of perjury. And the other thing, although not in the party's briefs perhaps, is the first sentence was pre-Foster, the second sentence of the hearing was after Foster.
But,
I don't think the court
But Pierce doesn't implicate Foster, does it?
Yes and no, in the sense that Foster, by cutting loose the need, by Foster restoring full sentencing discretion that had been limited prior to that as far as on the Senate Bill 2, which greatly restricted or greatly channeled how a trial court could exercise its sentencing discretion. Foster, by restoring that to full discretion, possibly there are cases out there where a defendant post-Foster would receive a different sentence than he would have received pre-Foster for the very same conduct, just because the trial court's hands are not so much restrained as they had been previously by Senate Bill 2.
Those don't involve the discretion of the trial judge. Those involve the statutory mandate that you must impose the minimum when maybe judges felt that I must follow the law, but I would prefer, or if I could exercise my discretion, I would impose a sentence greater than the minimum in this, based on the facts of this case. So those really don't impact this situation. We've got a situation where a defendant was convicted And then the number of counts, the amount of criminal activity is reduced, and the sentence is the same. And that's somewhat incongruent in my mind.
The state would submit that's just a reweighing that's allowed under 29.29.11 and 0.12.
Thank you. I understand your argument.
I would like to reserve the rest of my
thank
time.
Thank you, Mr. Shockley. Mr. Hardwick.
Mr. Hardwick, this sentence was not actually the same. He received 8 years on the second time, not 25, correct?
The package is lower. Individually, the two sentences at issue are higher.
Now, this second case resulted in a plea, did it not?
Correct.
And in looking at a plea, there's a give and a take between the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge. Yeah, I mean, when I was a trial judge, if you wanted to drop your plea, I would sometimes agree, but I would give you the maximum on the ones you pled to, whereas if you were found guilty of all of them, I might not have. There is that give and take, is there not?
Yes.
And the judge was free to engage in that give and take since this was a brand new case in terms of sentencing.
The state and the defendant and the judge weren't allowed to engage in that give and take, but what they didn't do here is do a jointly recommended sentence or waive any sentencing issues. And the defendant never waived his rights under Saxon to have the sentencing package doctrine applied to his case. He never waived
it. That's if you assume it was a sentencing package doctrine, but when he pled guilty to fewer counts, he knew what the maximums were for each of those counts, and he knew, because this was a new sentencing, he could draw the maximum.
Yes, but the state also knew the state versus Saxon existed, and they also knew that anytime you increase a sentence on a count, it raises Pierce problems, and that they might have to deal with that on appeal. And I'm involved right now in a plea negotiation with the state in a murder case, and the state's saying, you must have a jointly recommended sentence. If you don't agree to a jointly recommended sentence, we're not going to accept your plea agreement. The state could have done that in this case, and we wouldn't be here.
And similarly, your client could have said, no, I'm not going to risk any maximum sentence on the four I'm pleading to, and I'm going to go to trial.
Yes, he could have. And is there, go ahead.
Mr. Hardwick, I wanted to verify something. This Justice Stratton stated it was a brand new case. Are we, I'm confused on that. On remand, were we not still within the same case number and so
meant
on?
In sentencing,
have the same case. It wasn't a situation where the prosecutor then filed a new information and we started out
with the two charges involved that where I'm contesting here today. No, the state did. There was uncharged conduct in the first case that became charged conduct in the second case involving the tapes to the family members, but that's not at issue here. And the only difference that that matters is that the original trial, he was denying it and was being angry and defensive. And at the second sentencing hearing, the trial court expressly said he found that the defendant was sincerely remorseful for the effect that it's had on his son.
Since we're looking at each offense individually, at least that's what Saxon tells us to do. Each offense individually. On the second sentencing, what was the change in the offense sentences individually, if you would?
Okay, and I have a table on page 3 where, with one small mistake. And the vandalism charge, he went from 6 months consecutive to other counts to 12 months consecutive.
6 months concurrent, wasn't it?
And I wrote concurrent, and that was an error on my part. I apologize.
Okay, that should be second.
And also, as to the count 15, the illegal assembly chemicals for drugs, he went from 4 years consecutive to 5 years consecutive. What I think is important here is the state is looking at Saxon and thinking it's only about 2953-08 remands on appeal, or it's only about res judicata. And this court could have taken that very narrow view of Saxon when it wrote it, but this court rooted Saxon in this definition of sentence under 2929-01-FF and 2929-14, and what it held is the unit of measure in Ohio, as opposed to many other states in the federal government, is the offense. Now, as an administrative convenience, we often group, and the state groups offenses within one case number and assigns one case number with the clerk, but the unit of measure is the offense. And that's why in BZAC, this court could rule that you could have a void judgment on one offense, but have it not affect the rest of the cases. Because we look at this offense by offense, not as an entire case. We don't look at this as a package. And then that the General Assembly was looking at the predictability count by count rather than the convenience of looking at everything as a package. I just want to say one thing we're not arguing here is we're not arguing that the judge must not consider uncharged conduct or has to look at tunnel vision. But when deciding how much time to give this defendant for vandalism, the judge, we assume, looked at the entire set of conduct the first time around and looked at, hey, this was someone who was bumping a moving police car. And that's...
So, counsel, you don't think that the additional charge that was present in the second sentencing is sufficient change in order to warrant the actions of the sentencing judge here?
Actually, the opposite is true, because all those facts were available to the judge the first time, and the only difference was that this time Mr. Bradley accepted responsibility for it instead of just having the judge hear the tapes of the conversation that Mr. Bradley denied the behavior. And I see a contradiction in the state's argument here. The state is arguing the importance of judges being able to look at uncharged conduct, but then saying, well, there's a huge difference now that this uncharged conduct is now a conviction as opposed to uncharged conduct. And I would suggest to this court that as far as sentencing goes, it doesn't make that much of a difference in Ohio.
But did the first time around, he didn't take responsibility for, and it was a question whether that was an offense, correct? It was played or it was heard, but it wasn't conceded by the defendant that this was a chargeable activity. And then the second time, he does take, and there is no question, this was a criminal act.
I think it was disputed, but I would argue, and it's not reasonably disputed in the first case. And the judge is looking at a defendant who's defying, when there is a tape of his illegal behavior, defying the existence of that tape almost. As opposed to in the second case, he's saying, yeah, that was me, and I'm sorry, and I regret it. And quite frankly, I see this happens a lot, I think, in drug cases, where once you get the defendant away from the drugs in prison for a year or two, they often, they have a different view on the world. And I've even had clients say, thank judges for prison terms, because they start to understand what was going wrong with their life. They start to get away from the drugs. One thing, the state brought up the possibility that Foster might have changed in this case, the existence of Foster. And in the first district, the Johnson case that I cited in my brief, the trial court expressly on the record said that Foster, as a result of his discretion now under Foster, was going to increase the sentence. He was shackled by the Comer findings, but now he's unshackled and wants to give a higher sentence. If that's what the trial judge had done here, I'd be in a very different position. The trial judge had said, I would have given you the maximum the first time, but I couldn't because of Foster. We wouldn't be here today, or I would have a much, much weaker case, I'd be arguing. But here the judge, and I think the only plausible reading of what the judge said here is that the judge thinks that a higher aggregate sentence is a good idea and was trying to reach and had a preordained idea of what the ideal sentence was.
Even in light of the judge's statements on the record that he had looked at it freshly,
yes,
on this remand.
Yes, because as a number of the statements from the court might indicate, the only fresh facts the judge had here was a remorseful defendant as opposed to an unremorseful defendant. And that can only, and there's case law under Pierce that if you go back from a plea and go to trial and show that you're remorseless and show that you're no longer taking responsibility, well, they can nail you for that. And you deserve it, and deservedly so.
Are you arguing that a judge, when he takes a reduced plea to charges, does not have the discretion to increase the sentence on the charges he accepts as part of that negotiation process?
Only if there are new facts that would support
that. No, I'm talking about in general. A judge, if you're saying on resentencing, the judge could not look at the fact that there was plea reduction or in the number of charges in this case, then that has to be across the board because that's a new factor.
And I think that, and if this court had not, the General Assembly had not rejected the sentencing, if this were a sentencing package mm-hmm. doctrine state, then the judge could. But this court this court acknowledges the General Assembly has.
I never considered a sentencing package when I agreed to a plea negotiation, and I said I'm going to give you more if you plea to less, but I'll let you plea to less, or otherwise you go to trial. I never considered that a sentencing package. You consider that a sentencing package? That a judge can decide to take a plea to half the charges, but give more time for some of those charges?
Yes, and because what the in paragraph 8 of Saxon, this court went much beyond looking at 2953 and said the state leaves the sentencing judge no option but to assign to a particular offense but to assign a particular sentence to each, and this court italicized each of the three offenses separately, and this court italicized separately. The statute makes no provision for grouping offenses together and imposing a single lump sentence for multiple felonies. With all due respect, Your Honor, I think that's what you're suggesting. That's the approach that this court took in Saxon in trying to interpret 2929.01 and 2929.14. And that prohibits the conduct that Your Honor is suggesting. I also want to, now I want to get
does
to...
Does that argument work in the reverse as well? That because there are multiple charges, the judge will say, well, if there were fewer charges, I might make the sentence on each one longer, but because there's more charges, I'm going to make the sentence on each one a bit shorter. Would a judge be prohibited from doing that too?
In some circumstances, Saxon would do that. Saxon would prohibit that. If the defendant had, for instance, not appealed three convictions, three sentences, and come back with uncharged conduct or new conduct, then yeah, the defendant would be prohibited from addressing those three charges. And I think it's important to remember when the state came and stood at this podium, not this prosecutor's office, and asked this court to create the sentencing package doctrine, to reject the sentencing package doctrine, they were doing so just for that reason. What was happening is that on Foster remands, people would have a five-count case where there was a problem with one count, and they were asking to be resentenced on all of them, and then the trial judge would make a new mistake on one of them, and then they'd appeal that, and then that's why the state came here and asked to reject the sentencing package doctrine, because they were trying to narrow the scope of defendant's appeal and make it harder for my clients sometimes on remand to obtain a full de novo resentencing. And that was the rationale the state brought to ask this court to reject the policy argument behind asking the court to reject the sentencing package doctrine. And I think what happened here in the case is, because the trial judge knew he was increasing the count on a couple of the sentences, he had to make Pierce findings. He couldn't just be silent, as many judges can. He has to try to say something to rebut the presumption of vindictiveness. And the problem with the trial judge here did is the trial judge used an illegal factor to do so. The trial judge pretty much expressly said, I am looking at the sentence as a package and trying to rebalance things. Now, as a matter of policy, maybe it's good that you could allow trial judges to rebalance. Congress decided that it was good for federal courts. Many other states have decided the sentencing package doctrine is a valid policy doctrine, but it's just not the one we chose in Ohio.
So you would have us write that in the event there's a resentencing, the judge cannot increase the sentence unless there's a change in circumstance or new information or some rationale that was not present the first time around. Is that what you would have us write?
Correct. In order to rebut the presumption of vindictiveness, they must show something new. They cannot just increase the sentence for the sake because they think that the package is wrong. And the only other state appellate opinion that I was able to find on point was from Georgia, where they once had a sentencing package doctrine but have rejected it. And that court said, no, we're going to look at this count by count now. And if you increase the sentence on one count, you must look at that count in isolation. Now,
so counsel, if you deconstruct the sentence, which is in essence what you need to do here, and you look at a comparison between the first and the second sentencing, and you notice that there were 14 counts in the first sentencing charge.
16, I'm not sure.
I think there were 16 in the second when you added on the additional indicted offenses. And then you look at the fact that there were 27 years given in the first go-round, 8 years in the second sentence. A reduction, you know, a third of the sentence was imposed the second time, and about a third or so of the charges were he pled to out of the original, correct?
A small fraction, yes.
Okay, a fourth to a third. I mean, it's proportional. It certainly does not. Usually when I think of vindictiveness on the part of a judge, there's something more said by the judge. And here you're saying even if the judge was silent in his reason for imposing the second sentence under Foster, not giving any rationale, you would still look behind that and deconstruct it to the point where, well, there was nothing more for that judge to consider that he didn't have the first time or she had the first time around, so it's an invalid sentence.
Yes, and that's because the U.S. Supreme Court in Pierce versus North Carolina said that when a sentence is increased, there's a presumption of vindictiveness that it's the state's duty to rebut. So a silent record does not do anything to rebut that presumption. And a trial court must, if it's increasing the sentence, rebut the presumption of vindictiveness.
And you take Pierce and apply it to this case,
where the overall sentence was less, but the couple of charges were more, by saying that Saxton made that a packaging doctrine.
Correct, and that's the same way the Georgia Court of Appeals did, which it did.
Concede if this was a fresh sentence, no remand, the judge could give more time to a reduced plea. If you had 27 counts and the judge says, okay, I'll take a plea to 7, but I'm going to give you more time on 7, that's okay, but not on remand.
Even then, there may be some problems involving imposing a trial tax, which we all know exists, but it's often difficult to prove. Trial judges cannot, on the record, say, I will give you an increased sentence if you take the court's time and take a case to trial. That may be done, but it's not proper.
If you prevail, what is the outcome that you seek here?
The affirmance of the Court of Appeals that the case be sent back for resentencing.
On what counts?
Only on counts 4 and 15.
Only two counts?
Correct.
The rest of the sentence is fine, and the court could on remand impose the same sentence that it has if it provides a justification for it under Pierce. Am I right?
And if the Court of Appeals found that explanation sufficient, and it'd have to rebut, they can't, it would, the Court of Appeals would have to find that the trial court actually did accept the findings and believe that they really did, that they weren't vindictiveness, that the court was not being vindictive.
In other words, you think the court might put in a pretext for its vindictiveness.
And then that's, the court's rulings may, sometimes Court of Appeals find that, matters stated in the trial court aren't the full reason.
Well, at the sentencing, the court said it believed in the sentence it imposed originally, or it wouldn't have imposed it. So it requires the court to look freshly at what the result is. After considering all that information, the court imposes on count 4, vandalism, a fifth-degree felony, 12 months. That's what it said. You want something more.
Well, what I want the court to do is say, I'm going to impose the same sentence I imposed before.
How about if it just...
And the appeals court is allowed to look behind the words in the transcript and say, is this correct? But if the court of appeal, if the trial court went back and came up with and imposed a higher sentence for a valid reason, and the Court of Appeals accepted that reason, then Mr. Bradley would have a very hard time winning his appeal.
Suppose I thought that he was going to learn his lesson and wouldn't involve himself in perjury, making phone calls to try to obviate this case and show some true remorse. That would be a good reason to impose a higher sentence, wouldn't it?
Well, it wouldn't be if he came back and he actually was remorseful and he said, I'm sorry, and I take responsibility for it.
Thank you, Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shockling, you saved just about a minute of your time.
Thank you. Very briefly, acceptance of the appellee's argument in this case would require trial courts to act in lockstep following a remand and to impose the very same sentence on remand for a given offense that they opposed initially.
Doesn't it really just mean that they have to follow Pierce and Saxon? They complement each other, don't they? Pierce says you have to, that there's a presumption of vindictiveness in the trial judge, if the U.S. Supreme Court has said this, so we're bound by it, it seems to me. And there has to be something on the record to indicate why the trial judge increased the sentence on a particular charge because of Saxon. I mean, you have to go charge by charge. What's dramatic about that?
Chief Justice Moyer, if the trial court does not have the ability following a remand, and in this case, in the context of a plea, to look at new at the charges, to look at new at the possibility of reweighing the charges, reweighing the conduct, and perhaps increasing the sentence on some, then what is the incentive for the state on remand to entertain the possibility of a plea agreement? Basically, in most cases, will there be anything new, you know, as far as that might satisfy as far as new evidence, as far as new that might shed light on the case? Maybe, maybe not. But even if there is nothing that sheds new light on the case, as far as how that's talked about in the context of Pierce, the state would submit that the trial court should be free to reweigh just because there are fewer offenses, because otherwise the state has no incentive to enter into a plea agreement.
Well, counsel, the way the state can enter into the plea agreement and make sure that we're not hearing it is for an agreed-upon plea agreement where you have the defendant sign off on the sentence, which is a little problematic given the fact that, you know, the judge is not bound by the suggestion or the even the joint recommendation of a plea. But that certainly would be something to put on the record.
The state's concern with that is, let's say in this case we would have done that, and let's say there would have been an agreement to make it 12 months on the one and make it 5 years on the other. What's to prevent a defendant then down the road from bringing a petition for post-conviction relief saying trial counsel was ineffective for recommending such a deal? Because you, in effect, are increasing...
There's no way that you can ever circumvent a defendant if they want to repudiate the deal and charge ineffective assistance of counsel. That's just comes with the territory.
It may come with the territory, but from the state standpoint, would it succeed? Could a defendant succeed saying that my trial counsel basically threw overboard my rights under Saxon by making me agree to an increased sentence on some of the offenses on remand? And the state would submit it would not, it's a chance it would not want to take.
You've used your time, Mr. Shockley.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.